Welcome back to a new episode of the Insomniac's Guide to Lore. Today we're exploring the history and lore of Imperial Knights. The content is based on the book, The Imperial Knight's Companion. I've simply edited it to better suit my narration, and all credit belongs to the respective authors. We'll be going over a brief overview of the history and lore of the Imperial Knights. With the formalities out of the way, let's begin. A knight is a marvel of Dark Age technology, a towering bipedal war machine, piloted by a noble scion of an ancient knightly house. They measure as much as 40 feet in height. Each knight's suit is adorned with hand-sculpted plates of adamantium armor, decorated with ornate heraldry and honor markings. Knights are no less deadly for all their splendor, armed with potent weapons of war and capable of trampling their enemies like insects. Each knight is the equal of countless lesser foes. The forge worlds of the Adeptus Mechanicus produce numerous marks of knight suit. From the swift and deadly lancers to the towering and heavily armored knight crusaders. However, two designs in particular have proven enduringly popular for their balance and utility. The knight paladin wields a deadly rapid-fire battle cannon, firepower equal to that of a squadron of lesser war engines. With its range, versatility, and thunderous stopping power, the paladin's primary weapon allows it to bombard the foe from range or blast them up close with equal ease. On the other hand, the knight errant suits those nobles with an especially aggressive temperament. Its thermal cannon is a comparatively short-ranged weapon. But the horrifying devastation it can cause is more than worth the risk of closing in on the enemy. Of course, the huge firearms of the knights are not their only weapons. Most knight suits are covered with heavy stubbers. These are used to mow down masses of lightly armored enemy infantry, who might otherwise pose a threat to the knights by their sheer numbers. Furthermore, every knight wields an enormous Reaper-class chainsword. These roaring combat weapons are the size of a small tank in their own right, and a skilled noble can use their Reaper to duel even the largest enemy fighting machines. The churning teeth of a Reaper are all but unstoppable. Whether carving through the chitinous hide of a tyrannid bio-horror, or cleaving the head from a rampaging demon prince. When used to their full capacity, a force of knights paladin and knights errant are the match of almost any foe. Yet the knight suits are far more than a bipedal tank. Hidden deep within the armored shell of the war engine's torso sits an ancient ion shield generator. These priceless relics of technology project ion fields intended to deflect enemy fire, dissipate blasts of laser energy, and slow, solid-shot projectiles to a halt. The ion shield is linked into the noble's mind impulse control unit and can be angled in response to battlefield threats. While this does not provide an all-encompassing envelope of protection, as a void shield generator might, many nobles claim that their ion shields are infinitely superior. In the hands of a skilled wielder, an ion shield can be redirected with the speed of thought, interposing itself between the knight and its aggressors. With their shields angled to the fore, a detachment of knights can stride through even the fiercest incoming fire. Should a noble find himself surrounded by the foe while on the offensive, he can redirect his ion shield to protect his vulnerable flanks in an instance. Even a single knight is a significant asset upon any battlefield. But the armies of the Imperium can call upon entire knightly households, numbering dozens or even hundreds of these towering walkers. When they march to war, the ground shakes at their tread. Whole worlds can be brought to heel or burned to ash. Yet the nobles of the knightly houses are proud, stiff-necked individuals whose loyalties are dictated by complex webs of honor and obligation. How they came into their feudal heritage is a tale that spans many hundreds of thousands of years. It's a story that goes some way to explaining the knightly household's divided loyalties grudges, and obsessions in the 41st millennium. To fully understand the origins of the Night Worlds, one must look far back into mankind's history. Their beginnings lie during the dawn of the Age of Technology. In those years, humanity ventured out into the stars with hope and trepidation in their hearts, seeking to extend their dominion over the vast and mysterious gulfs of space. Though the human race is keen to leap before looking, in this endeavor at least, it seems they were cautious. Colony ships soared out from the home world. They were tiny motes of life drifting through the endless black void. They sought worlds rich in resources, examining each planet for its mining and farming potential. Whenever a suitable world was found, the scout ships would mark it for colonization. The duty of settlement fell to the Long March fleets, massive squads of bulky, city-sized void ships, packed to the rim with human colonists. These ships set off with fanfares of hope and glory, pushing their way through space for decades at a time before reaching their assigned worlds. Yet, it was only upon making planetfall that the reality of their situation would strike many of the colonists. Their transport crafts were cannibalized to build their first settlements, and they had absolutely no chance of returning home. Often, the planets upon which they landed were already inhabited, either by monstrous predators or sentient alien races, aliens that resented the sudden appearance of these invaders from beyond the stars. Other worlds boasted more esoteric hazards, atmospheric shifts hostile to human life, or terrifying plagues. To protect them against all of these terrible threats, the colonists had their standard template constructs, miracles of technology, whose fragmentary remains are still prized to this day by the Adeptus Mechanicus. Each standard template construct allowed the settlers to flawlessly mass-produce a specific object or device without the need for skilled engineers. From domestic tools to weapons of war, the STCs were the single most important tool to ensure the colony's survival. Greatest amongst these vital devices were those that produced the bipedal exosuits, now known as knights. The knight suits were an incredible asset for the Long March colonists. These machines could stride unharmed through all but the most extreme of environments. They were invulnerable against dangerous atmospheres, high gravity, and even the hostile vacuum of airless worlds. Most importantly, they could be equipped for combat operations, marching to war against indigenous alien populations, or beating back deadly wilderness. In this capacity, the knight suits proved all but unstoppable, acting as the iron fist of interstellar human colonization and carving out new realms for mankind to prosper and thrive in. Even in those early days, the integration software that allowed pilots to bond with their knight suits possessed mind-altering properties. Over the years, notions of honor, duty, nobility and fealty were reinforced in the psyches of those who piloted them. As generations passed, the colonist pilots became champions of their people, then turning into the ruling class. They styled themselves as noble households and took the colonists they protected as their feudal subjects. The nobles handed off their more mundane duties to lesser men. Their knights were armored and decorated according to their station, exchanging their utilitarian outer shells for the full panoply of war. Though there were those who resented the overbearing rule of the knightly households, none could deny that they kept their subjects well protected from the ravages of pirates, raiders, and alien horrors. As the age of technology reached its pinnacle, the human race witnessed and produced ever greater wonders. Colonization of space had progressed rapidly. New methods replaced the old Long March ships. Infatuated with their own ingenuity, the human race reveled in its new technologies. On many worlds, they surrounded themselves with thinking machines, courting indolence and dependency even as they reached for the godhood that should surely be theirs. On other worlds, a new age was dawning, as the first psychically capable humans emerged, an incredible evolutionary leap that promised wonders beyond anything previously imagined. Amongst this age of glory and splendor, the night worlds remained conservative and inward-looking, tempered by the whispers of their nights, and still taming the wilds of their frontier worlds. The rulers of the night worlds cared only for governing their own societies. Foreshadowing the future Imperium, the citizens of these worlds learnt to avert their gaze from the stars and focus on the ground beneath their feet. They were judged by many as places of stagnation and ignorance. Yet these very qualities would see them weather the storm about to erupt. No scholar alive in the Imperium today knows the exact date that disaster struck. However, many place the beginning of the Age of Strife somewhere between the 22nd and 25th millennium. When the darkness closed in, it did so with horrifying swiftness. Thinking machines rebelled against their masters, slaughtering whole planetary populations like cattle, or plunging them into worldwide wars of mutual annihilation. Societies that had accepted psychers and mutants reaped sorry rewards for their tolerance, drowning in blood and atrocity. Monstrous and unnatural phenomena were unleashed, depopulating worlds in mere hours. Colonists died screaming amid madness and horror, or let loose world-killing weapons to secure their own destruction before a worse fate could consume them. Newly sparked warp storms consumed worlds, or even whole systems, trapping them in hells of their own making, from which none would escape. As the darkness engulfed one gleaming monument to human endeavor after another, the night worlds simply endured. Their very conservatism and backwardness had insulated them, ensuring they were forgotten by any who might otherwise have brought them to ruin. Many houses had renounced technology, with the exception of their night suits, choosing instead to rely on ancient, tried and tested means of survival rather than fallible machines. Thus, they were well prepared for the coming of the Long Night. They had also protected themselves from psychers. Their superstitious natures made them reject things they did not understand or did not trust. These oppressive measures would save many of them during the Age of Strife. Unlike worlds which had given in to the lure of a life made easy by technology and magic, as the lights went out across the galaxy, the night worlds shored up their defenses, stoked their watchfires, and continued as they had for hundreds of years. During this time, their neo-feudal societies became ever more insular. The knightly houses consolidated their power bases and defended their borders with grim tenacity. The night worlds became entirely self-sufficient. This reduced many planets to an almost primitive existence, as they farmed the land and mined the earth, like their ancient ancestors on Terra. Under the watchful protection of the knights, the people did not complain. They were content in the knowledge that they were safe from the threats that lurked within the wilderness of their worlds, or the monsters gazing down at them from the stars. It was during this period of isolation that the caste that repaired and maintained their lord's night suits rose to prominence. Though they were still vassals of the knightly houses, it was widely recognized that without such craftsmen, the armored suits of the nobles would cease to function, leaving their people defenseless. Indeed, despite the best efforts of both the nobles and craftsmen, many night worlds fell into decline, or else were overrun by the creatures that crawled from the darkness. Yet many more endured, stoic as ever, as the years became centuries and the centuries millennia. It was not until the glorious years of the Great Crusade that contact was re-established with the surviving Night Worlds. Rogue trader Militant Jeffers was the first to discover one of these scattered enclaves, coming upon the world of Crisis while pushing back the boundaries of Imperial space. Though the ravages of time had not been kind, Jeffers still recognized the potential in the towering fighting machines and the robust society that supported them. Upon reporting his findings, the rogue trader strongly recommended that these knights be returned to the Imperial fold, for their value as a military asset could not be overstated. He also asserted that where one Night World had survived, surely more must have done the same. He urged for them to be sought out and returned to the bosom of their race, so that they might aid in spreading the Imperial truth. This was to be the beginning of a subtle struggle. Even at the height of its power, the Emperor's realm was one of many competing factions, and all recognized the value of the Night Worlds. Not only were the Night Suits incredibly potent weapons of war, but their planets of origin were still rich in resources. Perhaps most important of all, these were worlds still rich with the marvels of the Age of Technology. Though many devices had been forgotten, abandoned or destroyed as the years passed by, the Night Worlds were still treasure troves of archaeotech and mechanical wonders. For this reason, it was the Mechanicum who strove the hardest to seize the Night Worlds for their own. In those early years of the Great Crusade, the knightly houses were beset by emissaries and envoys seeking alliance or rights on their worlds and within their systems. Rogue traders, Imperial officials, and tech magi all entreated newly found Night Worlds for their favor. In most cases, these diplomats and messengers would underestimate the political cunning of the knightly houses. Despite the obvious might of the Night Suits, a man setting foot upon these remote planets would often only see the crowded feudal cities and ancient ferrocrete keeps decorated with flags and banners. Townsfolk still used horse and water-driven machines, or coal and steam. Even the nobles in their ornate castle halls seemed like a relic of the past to someone that had crossed the void of space. They failed to realize that centuries of infighting and social conflict between the houses had honed their political instincts to a sharp edge. Whether diplomats came from nearby provinces or a solar system hundreds of light years away, the Night Lords could see the lies behind the promises. They would endeavor to forge their alliances with care. As the Great Crusade rolled out across the galaxy, the Mechanicum established hundreds of new forge worlds. Many were built amid the ruins of past glories, worlds once rich in the iron bounty of progress. Others were hewn from unsettled worlds, found to be well-positioned or heavy with natural resources. Yet regardless of the Mechanicum's stated reasons, it seemed that a disproportionately high number of their newly founded centers of power lay close to these surviving Night Worlds. Each time this happy coincidence occurred, the Forge World's senior magi wasted no time in dispatching missionaries to aid these long-abandoned enclaves of humanity. In return for the nobles' pledges of military aid, the Mechanicum offered the word of the Omnissiah and the ancient knowledge that came with it. The artisan castes of the Night Worlds had done what they could to stave off the rigors of time, yet precious few of the nobles' night suits still operated anywhere close to optimal, and many had ceased to function at all. Armor was riveted or even strapped into place. Damaged weapons were replaced with crude alternatives, long iron lances that would buckle after the first blow, or bulky, fuse-primed cannons that had to be manually served by gunnery crews. Electric, solar, or even steam-powered systems replaced damaged reactors, while ion shields flickered out and became a thing of the past. Yet the Mechanicum could replace all of these systems and more. By inducting the craftsmen and armorers into the mysteries of the cult Mechanicus, they could provide the Night Worlds with the ability, to regain their former glory. While few refused the tech priest's gift of knowledge, most did not give themselves over completely to the Omnissiah, instead retaining their own independence and swearing their allegiance to the Emperor instead. To this day, though, many knight suits, even those not officially bound to a forge world, bear the cog symbol of the Adeptus Mechanicus as a reminder of the eternal debt they owe to their benefactors. As for those night worlds that wholly accepted the aid of the Martian priesthood and the word of their Omnissiah, their nobles had given away much of their autonomy and freedom. Vows of allegiance now obligated the nobles to lend military aid to the Mechanicum whenever it was demanded. More insidious, however, was the change that had occurred in their artisan classes. The craftsmen who maintained the knight suits endured indoctrination and re-education at the hands of the tech priests. Most submitted willingly to this decade-long process, knowing the end result would be unsurpassed skill in the trade that they practiced for generations. As the Mechanicum inducted these craftsmen into their deeper mysteries, so they renamed them Sacristans and indoctrinated them into the cult Mechanicum. The Sacristans returned to their worlds offering unequivocal service, yet their allegiance was now to the Mechanicum. As the years passed, the Sacristans established themselves as a religious brotherhood, an order of half-remembered mysteries and veiled secrets. Gradually, they began to speak with one voice, soon coming to wield significant political power through the threat of withholding their knowledge and expertise. This did not work on every night world, for the Sacristans were still technically the nobles' vassals, and on some worlds, weight of tradition or force of personality subdued the Sacristans into subservience. However, this was the exception rather than the rule. While other organs of the Imperium had blustered, bribed and bullied in an attempt to win the night worlds to their cause, the Mechanicum had performed a slow and silent invasion that left the night worlds dependent upon them for their continued existence. Even so, the Mechanicum had not counted upon the fierce independence inherent in the night world's nobility. In the end, while many night houses would become beholden to the Mechanicum, many more would stand apart. A knight suit is a potent and deadly weapon, but without its noble pilot, it is a hollow shell. The process of bonding with a knight is a dangerous one, however, an apotheosis that not every aspirant survives. Knight suits are ancient machines, with complex and often belligerent machine spirits to match, and only the worthy may break such a beast to their will. Knights are controlled in a similar fashion to the great war engines of the Titan Legions through mind impulse control links that allow the pilot to wear their knight suit like a second skin. Indeed, the fluid direction that a noble has over his knight allows an ease of movement bettered only by the alien war engines of the Eldar. However, where the princeps of a Titan will often inhabit an amniotic tank or be cybernetically bound to his engine's bridge, the nobles who pilot knight suits interface with their towering machines through a device known as a throne mechanicum. At the heart of every knight's stronghold is an ancient and enormous structure called the Sanctuary. Each of these buildings appears roughly the same in design, a fortress that towers to well over 1,000 feet in height. These would have been amongst the first buildings constructed by new settlers upon making planetfall, intended both to train new knight pilots and to house the knights they would pilot, ornamented, adapted, and buried in the trappings of ritual over the millennia. These sanctuaries would now be utterly unrecognizable to those who built them, yet their function remains the same, for it is here that young nobles earn the right to pilot knights, and here that their armored suits lie dormant between battles. Within the sprawling chambers of the Sanctuary are operating rooms, lumen globes casting flickering light across their surgical augmentation cages and bubbling tanks of strange chemicals. Here, household medicis and sacristans convene, enacting long and elaborate surgical procedures on those noble sons who will soon come of age. Skull sockets and neural interface plugs are implanted, physical imperfections replaced with augmetics, and stimulant injections delivered to deep muscle tissue and bone cores. These procedures are drawn out and traumatic, performed with the minimal amount of anesthesia, in order to test the character of these potential pilots. Yet no amount of agony can fully prepare the young nobles for the terrors that await them in the infamous Chamber of Echoes. Having been physically prepared to integrate with a knight, the prospective pilots must face the ritual of becoming. In this barbaric rite, they are bonded to their knight in mind and soul, or else prove unworthy and pay the ultimate price. Led to the Chamber of Echoes, deep in the sanctuary's heart, the aspirants are presented with a number of empty thrones mechanicum. Each is set well back within a torchlit alcove, looming menacingly from amid a dense cowl of squirming shadows. The aspirants are instructed to seat themselves in the throne of their house. Once all aspirants are seated, hooded sacristans connect each to their assigned throne mechanicum. As the ancient devices whisper into life, the sacristans extinguish the torches and withdraw. They leave the aspirants in utter pitch darkness, at the mercy of the ghosts bound within their thrones. Over the course of the long, horrific night that follows, each aspirant must attempt to bond successfully with his chosen throne mechanicum. These thrones retain echoes of the many previous pilots that have imprinted their psyches upon them, echoes that now come forth and induce hallucinations and waking nightmares within the aspirants. Strange nerve impulses race through the young nobles' bodies, causing them to moan, twitch, and convulse. High, terrified laughter and sudden spontaneous sobs of misery cut through the darkness, accompanied by grunts, muttering, and the occasional bone-chilling scream. As the night wears on, the aspirants will depart the realm of the real altogether, falling into the churning sea of ghosts that resides within the neural network of their throne. During this strange trance, each prospective pilot must find the strength within to subdue the echoes of the past and drag themselves back to the present. So desperate a trial is this, that one aspirant in 10 does not survive. Their minds are burned out, and their sanity is shattered. Those who live will imprint their personality upon their throne mechanicum, seizing its neural space as a general seizes a fortress and planting their flag for all to see. When the torches are lit the next morning, and the surviving aspirants are freed from their thrones, it is a changed group of men who march from the Chamber of Echoes. The very chemistry of their brains has been altered, the tapestries of their souls unpicked and rewoven, just as their own imprint has been branded upon the soul space of their newly claimed throne. Forced to fall back upon their dominant personality traits to survive, the young nobles will find these characteristics forever exaggerated. The programming of the throne and the influence of its possession leaves the nobles with a lingering sense of duty, fealty, and nobility, one that will color their deeds and decisions forevermore. At the same time, their own emotions and characteristics will affect the throne they have claimed, and the knight into which it melds. This leaves some suits skittish and twitchy, while others become somber, aggressive, stubborn, or unflinchingly courageous. Over time, a knight suit will absorb dozens of neural imprints from generations of nobles, each one becoming a different aspect of the suit's personality. Whatever the case, the knight suit will awaken only at the behest of its newly imprinted pilot, until that noble is slain and becomes just another ghost in the machine. All the throne's mechanicum that have been imprinted to living nobles are stored in a single domed chamber atop the sanctuary. This vast space, known as the Communion Dome, is often heavily ornamented. Many boast stained glass domes depicting deeds of valor performed by the greatest nobles of the household. Others play host to elaborate iron-weave tapestries, hollow portraits or automata statuary commemorating mighty scions and famed nobles who have piloted the household's knights. Surrounded by this ornamentation, the imprinted thrones Mechanicum are arrayed around the chamber's walls. Though vacant, each gives off a palpable sense of imminence, as though its occupant has just stepped away for a moment and will soon take up his rightful place once more. When the nobles march to war, they do just that, ascending in pneumoliths to the Communion Dome and settling themselves into their thrones. As the neuro cabling clunks into their skull sockets, the nobles' thrones tilt backward and slide smoothly into waiting transit tubes, haloed by the strobing beams of hazard lighting, arrayed in the full finery of war. The nobles plunge hundreds of meters in a matter of moments, grav cushioning and mag rails ensuring their descent remains controlled. Their fall takes them down through the sanctuary into the Vault Transcendent, where their knights wait with carapace docks yawning wide. Wolfish grins of anticipation spread across noble features as the thrones spiral into the final delivery shafts, thumping neatly into place at the heart of each knight. Amid the clatter and whine of locking bolts securing and spinal plugs mating, the rising thrum of engines fills the vault. One by one, the knights awaken, klaxons howling war cries through the Vault Transcendent over the whine of hatchlocks securing and the snarl of Reaper chainswords revving up. Linked as one, his heartbeat pounding in rhythm with the throb of his knight suit's reactor, each noble mentally takes the helm of his knight suit and readies his walker to stride to war. That's the end of this short introduction to the lore of Imperial Knights. I'm truly grateful to you for sticking around until the end. I'd really like to do another episode on the Imperial Knights, this time exploring the different houses of knights. Please let me know if you are interested, or if you have other ideas for what you'd like to hear. Thanks again, and hope to see you soon.